This is the Modern Day Pirates.
Podcast Book Club, Episode 32, Guiltier Pleasure Books. In this volume, we talk about classy naked ladies, second breakfast, and stalking Neil Gaiman. From the Midwest, home of Judy Garland, I'm Amanda.
And from the home of Alan Alda, New Jersey, I'm Brandon.
How are you?
Happy Doctor Who Day, Amanda.
Oh my god, I forgot about that. How did I forget about that? Happy Doctor Who Day.
We are recording on Doctor Who Day.
Oh my god.
The new season starts tonight.
I'm nervous and excited.
Okay.
So let's get started. This podcast is now a year old, and I knew that it was coming up soon. I checked my email, I did a search, and I found out that about a year ago, we decided to start doing this podcast, and then we started doing it. So we have 32 episodes of this podcast. This is the 32nd episode. It's roughly a full day of recording.
Yes, the original one was added to iTunes on 4:30, April 30th. So
yeah.
I think we recorded like a week before that because we had I wasn't so slick with the whole process at that point.
Yeah, it was like 2.5 hours of us just like rambling that you had to edit down into the podcast itself.
Yes, which isn't so far how we do it now.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of rambling, and we didn't have any notes. We tried to find our old notes, but apparently we didn't even use notes until, like, episode 3.
Which is really funny. And so for the first episode, we decided to do guilty pleasure books. So for today's episode, we decided to go back and sort of briefly review what our guilty pleasure books then were, and then sort of talk about our new guilty pleasure books. So my guilty pleasure books, and I still feel guilty about calling them guilty pleasure books, because I think you like what you like and you shouldn't apologize for it. But one of my guilty pleasures is reading Stephen King. And I even met a girl last night who, when I said that I really liked Stephen King, she made a face and then sort of chewed me out for liking him. but I defended myself. Yeah,
really?
I was like, he's a good writer. And she said, no, he's not. And I don't know.
I think at this point in a lot of these authors that we kind of end up talking about in the guilty pleasure arena, like Stephen King and Tom Clancy and Michael Crichton, all the grocery store novelists, ones you buy in the grocery store. I think they've all had such prolific careers that I don't think you can make a face at them anymore. They've done an amazing thing with their writing.
They've like branded themselves so well.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. I love him anyway. I don't really care if anyone else doesn't like him. But then I also said in the first episode that I really liked the Lux series. And I still really like that series. It's a YA series about these rich girls in New York City in like 1900. And I think the whole thing with guilty pleasure is it's all about decadence. So those books are definitely decadent. And I think probably a good definition of a guilty pleasure book is one you don't want to be seen reading, or you would be, you know, obviously embarrassed if someone that you wanted to impress saw you reading this particular book, because books are status symbols, and what we read is, it's all about status.
Yeah, I think a lot of people just read so that they can brag about it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
And that's why I remember someone was talking about getting an ebook reader, and they're like, well, no one be able to see what I'm reading.
But that could be good sometimes. Like,
and I noticed that a lot with ebook readers is that people will immediately say, like, oh, I see you have a Kindle. And they're like, yes, I am reading this. And they have to say it because there's not a cover for them to show it. So it's like, yeah, I'm reading this very intellectual book. And you know,
couldn't you just like lie about that, though?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure most of them do. They're all reading Stephen King.
Yeah. Or like a bodice ripper.
Yes, they're reading softcore porn. Yeah. They could. Who would know?
Yeah, no one. Well, what was your original guilty pleasure book way in the day?
My original guilty pleasure books back in the original episode were alien abduction books. And I still believe that they are scarier than any actual horror books, because there's that level of them almost being, well, it could be true. They always say in the beginning this is based on true stories, based on true events. And I think when you add the layer of true to any scary thing, it pulls it forward for me. Especially if you believe in a lot of the stuff they're talking about, like I do. It definitely makes them very scary. And, you know, I really think the internet has sort of destroyed this genre of book for me. I used to be the main book that I used to read. Like back in, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it was like all I was reading. My book, I had a shelf just devoted to them on my bookcase. And, you know, I think the internet's so good at this kind of quick conspiracy things that kind of just, you know, most of them never pan out or anything. And you go on Wikipedia and you can spend, you know,
You can go full to a nights. Wiki coma.
Yeah, full nights reading about conspiracy theories and mythical animals and stuff.
Yeah.
Those articles are longer than most history and politics articles.
And then there's like full pages just like covered in links that are like, here's all of these cryptozoology things. And there's like way more pages than there are like religions in the world.
I would put money, and I'm not, I haven't looked at them, that the Loch Ness Monster Wikipedia article is probably longer than the Omar Gaddafi Wikipedia article.
That's, I would probably venture to guess that that's true. Well, so, then also in the first episode, we talked about Michael Crichton for like 20 minutes.
Yes, we just kind of, it wasn't even a planned, and I think half the episode is us talking about Michael Crichton.
I think nothing, we fangirl at him.
Nothing was exactly informative about what we were saying. There was a long diversion to talking about Jurassic Park. At such a level where I think we've tried not to ever mention Jurassic Park again, because it was just so much about it.
I think we need to do an actual Michael Crichton episode
that's structured and not just us ranting about him.
We're gonna do one of those coming up.
So Amanda, what's to add to the pile of guilty pleasure books where we have Stephen King like supermarket books, we've got young adult what would you call
like
rich girl books and alien abduction books. What are you going to add to the pile of guilty pleasure books?
Well, I'm going to add, it's more of a format. It's not, it's Lad Mags. That's like the UK name. It's sort of like men's magazines, kind of. Magazines like Maxim, like loud cars and scantily clad women and articles about scotch. And part of me thinks that I was like a rich old guy in a past life or something. Because like that's what these magazines make me think of. Like, sort of like rich jerks a little bit.
I don't know. Maxim makes me think about rich jerks. It makes me think about douchebag teenagers.
Yeah. Who then grow up to be rich jerks.
Yes.
You know, it's like tips on like how to buy cigars and stories about romantic encounters and like not safe for work photo shoots that are airbrushed like crazy. That like not even real people. Like real people don't live lives like this.
My brother still subscribes to Maxim. I think actually I got him the subscription for Christmas, but he loves it magazine. And I noticed something about Maxim recently when I was in the bathroom and it was the only thing to read was none of the articles are longer than a page.
No, yeah, especially in Maxim in particular. There's like a couple others too, like Radar, which I don't even know if that one exists anymore.
And they have a giant picture too, so the articles aren't longer than a page in the giant picture. So there's maybe each article is maybe about 50 words.
Yeah, but then there's also like an infographic maybe, or like a chart of some kind. You know, so it's like not even longer than that. So if you don't actually want to read the article, you can look at the picture, look at the chart, and have all this new information in your brain. About scotch. But so my specific guilty pleasure book that's sort of in this genre a little bit is, it's, you know, it's obviously not a book, it's a periodical, it's a magazine, is Playboy. I love Playboy. And I always have to defend it. Like, I wrote a paper in grad school about Playboy. It was specifically about the horror fiction published in Playboy from 1969 to 1971. And I want to subscribe because I'm not a subscriber. I just sort of get them when people give them to me. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'll do that today because it's actually
so you are basically a sixth grade boy.
Yes, I am.
Just well, finds anyways, the Playboys.
And... It's true. Well, it's so funny because when I was writing that paper, it was like 2 years or 2 or 3 years ago that I was writing that paper. Everyone in library school, because it's only like there's only like 90 people in the program at Wisconsin. They all knew that I was writing this paper. So like I would just get Playboys like dropped off in my mailbox at school.
That's a little creepy.
I know. And then one day.
Just mysteriously had Playboys left on your doorstep.
It was really weird. One day there's the jail library group because there's a jail here. And so people collect books to bring to the jail so that the inmates have something to read. But they're not allowed to have essentially what they deem as porn. So they're not allowed to have Playboy. So
yeah, well, you can imagine they would become some sort of currency.
Like cigarettes. So this girl walks up to me with this like monstrous stack of Playboys. Like I swear there were like 25 Playboys in this stack. And I'm sitting there in the library and she just plops them down on the table and walks away. Because she was like, these were all donated to the jail library group and we can't give them to the inmates. And I was like, you're amazing.
You see, Amanda, you're... more adventurous than I, because if there's one book and magazine I would never pick up used, it would be Playboy.
Thankfully, most of them were just like, it seemed like they were people who like didn't want them anymore or who had were too lazy to cancel their subscription, because a lot of them were still like in the little plastic baggie that you get them in when you get them in the mail. Okay, that's
important. Yeah, it's protective. It's
a protective plastic baggie. But, you know... Playboy is great because there's short stories still to this day by authors like Margaret Atwood. There used to be stories by, you know, Richard Matheson and John D. MacDonald and interviews with political figures. There's an interview like from back in the day with the guy who started the American Nazi Party. And he's interviewed by the guy who wrote Roots, who is African-American. So this black guy interviewing this American Nazi Party guy, You can read that interview on their website. It's amazing.
I would argue it's probably the most mass-distributed short story collection.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that because there's no place to publish short stories. Like, Esquire still sort of publishes them sometimes.
The New Yorker.
But, like, a lot of the times men's magazines like Esquire and stuff like that was the only place you could publish short stories. And that's still one of the only places you can find short stories.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite facts about Playboy was Shel Silverstein.
Yeah. He went on cartoons.
He went on to be, like, you know, our beloved children's writer.
The Giving Tree. Light in the Attic.
Yeah, with the Sidewalk Gangs. He got his start in Playboy. And he was proud of it. You know, at the time, it was a big badge of honor for writers to have appeared in Playboy.
Yeah. You know, and it's... So many people got their start in Playboy doing that kind of stuff, like either doing the little cartoons or writing the little jokes or writing short stories or writing poetry or, you know, being a photographer. But it's the kind of thing where you still, like, I still don't even really want to be seen reading it in public because it's not safe for work and it's not really safe for public because there's, you know, boobs and things in it. Even though they're so airbrushed, they're not even actually breasts anymore. They're just plastic. But it's such a good magazine. Like, when I was doing that project, I was looking at Playboy on microfilm, so all the pictures were essentially blacked out, and I kept forgetting that I was reading Playboy.
Well, I think there's even more of, there's that joke where people say, I read Playboy for the articles, but now
really,
I think you can. Everyone that's a subscriber to Playboy, unless they're, you know, really dumb, are getting it for the articles because you don't need to find...
The internet exists,
and you can get a lot of things there. And the stuff in Playboy is very tame.
Very tame.
It's very tame. It's very...
It's almost tasteful, which is
tasteful.
Bizarre.
It is almost tasteful. In fact, it is kind of tasteful. Because that's what they're known for. And they've kind of decreased, I think, the amount of nudity in it. Because they know, like, people just go on the web.
Yeah.
They don't need us for that anymore. Well, it used to be the only place to get it.
And now Playboy even has, like, their own you know, they have their own website. They have, like, the digital version of Playboy that has videos and way more nudity that's way more graphic. So, but the magazine is just, I think the nudity in the magazine is almost there as, like, a, well, we've had this forever, so we're going to have some still.
Yeah, it's like a reminder.
Yeah, we're still
Playboy. Yeah, I'll admit it. I'm a long time subscriber. I love Playboy. It's a cheap subscription. It's like
$10, right?
$10, $10, $15. And it comes in a black wrapper. You don't have to worry about people. But you know, I really don't think the stigma really exists anymore. People might joke about it when they see them.
Yeah.
But it's like really. Like I said, it's not – the internet has kind of destroyed that for Playboy, I think. And I love the story of my professor from school. This is actually the guy that got made me – not made me, but inspired me to subscribe. He was one of my writing professors, one of my political writing professors at my master's program. And we got talking in class about how much he loved Playboy.
Yeah.
He was a – lifetime subscriber. His parents, when he graduated college in the 60s, got him, because at the time you could do this, because magazines,
like $100 or something, right?
Yeah,
it was like for life. You got
it, was $100 for
and
life.
They stopped doing it at some point,
but they still have to honor them. So he has like he has boxes in his garage, just
boxes
of like every Playboy from the 60s.
Oh, I want those because those are like my favorites.
Yeah, and. Like, so that's kind of the one of the running jokes in the department was he had, you know, every Playboy from the 60s locked in his garage. But, you know, he's a political writer. It's that he made his career on, and some of the best, he argues some of the best political writing and interviews were found in Playboy.
Yeah. It is. And it's fantastic. It's, you know, and actually right now, because I think Hugh Hefner is sort of, he's a genius. He was, you know, 27 when they started Playboy in 1953, so just think about that. And there's actually a really good documentary that I've been meaning to watch. It's on Netflix streaming right now. It's called Hugh Hefner, Playboy, Rebel, something else. But it's, you know, all about how he basically started this new sexual revolution in the United States with his magazine that, you know, dared to show women's breasts, but also right next to political writing and, you know, art criticism.
Yeah. So the trick the guys into reading something intellectual.
Exactly. Now,
so my books are going to be novelty books.
Oh, I love those.
And, you know, Barnes & Noble has hundreds of them and basically calls it the clearance section, I've always noticed.
Yeah, they always have that huge sticker on them that's like $2.
There's no novelty book section in Barnes & Noble, but there is. It's called the clearance section. They seem to go right there. It's like they're embarrassed to have them, so they keep them in this constant state of 1 foot out the door, you know?
Oh.
But, you know, let's be honest. They're great gifts. These are books that you would never buy for yourself because they're either big or fat and they're about something odd, like, you know, pictures of guitars or, you know, the best impressionist art. But you know, they're often called coffee table books, and I'm reminded of when Kramer on Seinfeld makes a coffee table book about coffee tables that turns into a coffee table.
It's so meta.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes I get a little sick of them and I, you know, end up throwing them out or donating them, and, you know, I don't actively seek them out, but once in a while, a good one comes to me as a gift that it's just like, wow, I love this book. And because it's the perfect amount of, you just, you keep the book laying around and you're waiting for, you're waiting to leave to go somewhere, or you're waiting for something to download or whatever. And you just pull out the book and you read a page or a caption, you know?
Yeah.
And so I got this book for Christmas this year, well, last Christmas now, and it's called The World According to Twitter.
Oh, cool.
By David Pogue and his 500,000 followers. And it is a book about Twitter. And yes, there's a book of tweets. It actually exists. And what he did was, instead of writing a book, every week he posed a question on Twitter for a year.
Yeah.
And then he wrote down the best responses to that question. And he curated them, picked out the best ones. And so each section is just, you know, a question and then 140 character answers to that question. And you would think that it would be inane and stupid, but because he had 500,000 followers and is a very good writer, he's the New York Times tech writer, that he can, you know, pull out some great stuff. And there's some really funny stuff in here.
Give us an example.
Like, you know when the honeymoon's over when you quit blaming the dog. Date night equals Taco Bell.
Oh.
Three words, bathroom door open. The dog has more pet names than you. So, like, you know, it's really funny, and it wouldn't be something that I would buy for myself, which is the perfect gift. That's the kind of gift that you want.
I like that.
Make up a clever title for a sequel to a famous movie. So there's Wall F. Think about that one. 12 Angrier Men. Star Trek, The Search for Star Trek. So it's great. It's really good.
That sort of seems like also the kind of thing you could sort of whip out at a party and just ask those questions of all of your guests and then
Exactly. Like this one, this will be the last example I give. The Never-Ending Story, The Final Chapter.
Think about that one.
So, you know, these novels, like this is a perfect example of, you know, this book exists just for fun. You know, it's a novelty book. It's not something that was made to make any sort of point or tell a great story. It just... Sometimes you need to read a book that's just Anne Getty's pictures of babies.
I met her at the mall once when I was like in fifth grade.
Really?
She came to Primus Park and was like right in front of that where Walden Books used to be.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was there at the time. Yeah. She signed my poster of those babies and cabbages.
She was just sitting in front of an abandoned Walden Books selling
But like no one knew who she was. So there was just like this blonde like woman from New Zealand like sitting at this table and like no one was going up to her. And
really?
Me and Jesse Feingold went up to her because we were obsessed with those pictures.
Yeah, I know Jesse's obsessed with Anne Getty's.
And we like brought our posters. We were like, "Hi, Miss Getty's, can you sign our posters?" And we talked to her for like 20 minutes. It was bizarre.
Yeah, if you don't know what we're talking about, Anne Getty's is a famous photographer, makes amazing pictures of babies.
Yeah, like the really cute pictures of like the babies in cabbages and the babies like in flowers, like all those pictures. That's Anne Getty's. And she's like...
She was Tumblr before Tumblr existed.
Yeah.
It's just pictures of babies doing people things.
Yeah, she's amazing. And
but very artsy. They're not just, you know, creepy baby posters.
They're like babies all, doing things.
They're all like, very, very well done.
They're very tasteful pictures of babies.
Yeah. What the frack are we reading this week? I've been spending a lot of time in Portal 2 and editing Laughing Historically. A new episode just came out about Easter Bunny. But I just started reading Bill Bison's A Short History of Nearly Everything.
Have you heard of that? I love him.
It's the first chapter broke my mind. I had bought it on my iPad a while ago, and I was laying in bed, and I couldn't go to sleep, and I started to read it, and then I couldn't fall asleep even more, because it just makes you feel so insignificant, but in a good way, in the best way possible.
Yeah.
It's just a complete mind F.
He's so funny too. I love the way he writes.
Yeah, he reads a lot like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh yeah,
the excerpts from the book itself. Like that's kind of how he writes. Like it's very. I could definitely picture it read in an English accent.
Yeah, he's from Iowa too.
Yeah.
But he lived in England for a long time. So I have an audiobook of his that I listened to a couple weeks ago. And it's him reading it, but he sounds, you know, just Midwestern sort of no accent. But then every couple words, because he lived in England for like 25 years, he'll do like a British thing. It's really weird.
Yeah, there's definitely that layer of humor. So you can tell that he was immersed in that culture.
Yeah.
So what are you reading, Amanda?
Well, I'm going between several things, but mostly I've been rereading Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. Which I did a little episode of the video version of this podcast about that. So that's going to be going up in the next couple days. I love that book. Oh, book news. What's going on in book news land?
Well, Game of Thrones premiered last week. Game of Thrones premiered. Did you get to watch it, Amanda, yet?
I don't have HBO.
Oh, well, there's ways that you can watch it.
I know,
still.
I need to.
It is very good. It is so close to the book. I think this is any, I think certain books should be done in TV series now. Mm-hmm. Now that TV has ramped up their production and they're basically at movie level production now, mm-hmm. They're not leaving anything out. It's like an audiobook come to life.
That's awesome. And I heard that it, like, after the first episode, it was already renewed for a second season.
Yeah. Once they saw that, like, the buzz around it, they're like, yeah, we have to keep going on
this.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. It's so close to the book, and I'm glad now people that wouldn't necessarily sit down with a 7-book series that's, you know, mm-hmm. 1,000 pages each, like a 7,000 page series. These people are now are watching it because it's so close to how the book is portrayed. If not, I haven't read it in a while, but like, I would venture to say it's almost word for word.
Sweet.
It's that close. So I'm glad it's getting out to people. Like True Blood, I don't think many people would sit down and read the Sookie Stackhouse series.
No, I read the first book and then the series is better.
Yeah. So it's the same kind of idea. And Boardwalk Empire is also based on a book. HBO seems to be very good at taking books that mm-hmm. aren't approachable and making them into amazing series.
Sweet.
Also in the world of fantasy, it's a big fantasy week. Mm-hmm. The Hobbit has started filming, Amanda.
Sweet. Oh my god.
There's videos of Martin Freeman acting like Bilbo and Ian McKellen being an old queen. And
I love him.
Complaining about things.
That makes me so glad. Well, yeah. I'm so happy about that.
It's also a lot of big announcements came out about it. It'll be the first film filmed in 48 frames per second. And let me tell you why that's important.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Most movies are filmed at like 24 frames per second.
So this is double that.
Yes. Well, because you ever watch a movie and things start to get like fast and there's like that blur, that motion blur?
Doctor Who does that sometimes, I think.
Everything
scenes.
Does it.
Yeah.
Every film does it. When things start moving, life moves at a lot faster than 20 frames per second.
Oh, okay.
We can see a lot more than 20 frames per second. The whole idea of film is that it's a bunch of still images that are fooling us into thinking that it's motion.
That's crazy.
You know? Think of it. That's what film is.
Yeah.
So if you double the frames per second, you're getting that much closer to reality.
Oh.
And a reality of movement. And a lot of directors say that this is more important. And this is more important in making something look realistic than 3D. Those that have seen it say that it looks more realistic than 3D could ever look.
That's awesome.
Because the movement looks real. It looks... Like, it doesn't look like it was filmed. It looks like it's in that, like, a box in the wall, and you're watching it.
That's so cool. Okay, now I'm really, I was really excited before, but now I'm even more excited.
Yeah. So stay tuned. There will be lots of Hobbit updates because it is my deep love
mm-hmm.
is that book. Lord of the Rings is great, but The Hobbit is where it all started for me. The love of books and everything all started with The Hobbit.
I like Second Breakfast. So you know that book, that Three Cups of Tea book, mm-hmm. about the guy who, you know, was hiking. He's trying to hike K2, like the second highest mountain in the world, and then he got lost, and all these people in Afghanistan, you know, in this little village saved his life, and then he decided, oh, I'm going to give all this money to these schools, and I'm going to start schools all over the world for girls because these people saved me. Well, apparently a lot of that is bogus. And John Krakauer, so 60 Minutes did this, like, huge expose thing last week, and John Krakauer, the guy who wrote Into Thin Air, thinks that this guy is a liar. And he was even friends with this guy a couple of years ago, gave him a bunch of money to his charity. It's a really dramatic story about how, you know, maybe when he got back from Afghanistan, he told a couple of tall tales that just sort of spiraled into this story. But people in Afghanistan, like on the ground, are saying, yeah, that this is crap. His charity might be corrupt too. Like someone was saying that the charity is essentially just his bank account that he doesn't have to account for.
Ooh.
And it sucks because it's such a nice, like, if the story that he told in the book is true, like that's such a nice story. Because it's, you know, like, these people saved me, so I gave back to them, and it's just, it sucks. So that's a whole big dramatic thing that's going on in bookland. So don't lie about things in your nonfiction book, everyone who might write one in the future.
So, Amanda, the Atlas Shrugged movie came out. Yeah.
Awesome.
And it is luckily completely panned by critics. There's a 6 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, wait. Out of like 100?
Out of 100.
Crap.
It was, if you don't know the background of, and Atlas Shrugged is his famous Ayn Rand book. I actually like it a lot, even though I'm a very liberal person. I really like Atlas Shrugged as a book. Yeah, not so as,
I just don't like her writing style. Yeah.
I like it as a book. I don't like it as some people think of it as like a...
A lifestyle.
A lifestyle and everything. It, you know, the Tea Party people love Atlas Shrugged. That's kind of how this book came about. It was a very, like, a uber conservative group of people got the money together and made, like, an indie production of it. It has, like, no talent.
Is Kirk Cameron in it? I kind of hope Kirk Cameron is in it.
He must be an investor or involved somehow. It's very similar to how the Left Behind thing came about, where it's like people with a lot of money that wanted to see it come out. It only aired to about 1,000 theaters, which is big for an indie movie, but not big that big.
Yeah.
It got the book up to number 4 on Amazon, which is scary. It seems like every time there is a conservative revival in the country, Atlas Shrugged seems to become discussed again.
That's weird.
So I'm glad it got panned. I doubt they're going to make another. They said if this movie's not a success, they're not going to make another one. It's only like a section of the book because the book's gigantic. It's not the full story. They couldn't do that in a full movie. It's really not that, like, it's not that filmable of a movie, if at all.
Yeah, it's a mostly like discussion.
Yeah.
And like people like talking to each other, which, you know, that's dialogue, but there also needs to be like stuff going on for a movie to be exciting.
Railroads, a lot about railroads.
Yeah.
So
that's thrilling.
Yeah. but no, yeah, like I said, I think it's one of those books that everyone should read. Everyone should read one, Ayn Rand. If they're going to say that they are a reader, they should.
Yeah.
They're important books.
I read The Fountainhead.
Fountainhead's good, ago. Too. Yeah. they're good books, I think, but think people get it. It's like, to me, it's a lot like Scientology, where you have a fiction book that people made into a religion.
Yeah.
You know, like, she did have these uber thoughts, but she wrote a book, a fiction book, you know? I have a hard time believing that anyone initially when they sat down to write a fiction book thought that it was going to become a way of life. My view on Scientology was, you know, he sat down to write a fiction book, saw that people thought that it was religion, and was like, yeah, that's the ticket to having a yacht full of young boys.
Yep. Yeah.
So Atlas Shrugged. Neil Gaiman is making an American Gods audiobook for its 10th anniversary, Amanda.
Oh, I love him. And he lives not too far away from me.
So you can go stand outside his house and freak him out.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. I know he lives near Minneapolis, but he never says exactly where he lives because I'm pretty sure he would just get stalkers all the time. Oh, yeah.
I know you like American Gods, right?
I do. Love that book.
That's like his most, probably his biggest work.
It's his opus.
His opus. I think Coraline is my favorite of his books, but it's American Gods is his, like, it's his kind of adults novel. And so what he's doing is he's using the power of the internet, as Neil Gaiman likes to do, because he's very smart. And he is making, like, my favorite type of audiobooks, the audiobooks that are, like, performances. They're, like, little plays.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, audio plays, where every part is cast and by actors and everything. So what he's doing is he put out a tweet and this contest where you could submit yourself to become a character.
Oh, sweet.
And it's a contest. So you go on there, you listen to everybody's reading an excerpt from the book, and then you vote on which one you want to see.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I would ask you to vote for my friend Emily Asbury. I will provide a link in the show notes, please. They I think they're only letting the top 20 get in, and she's about 200-ish votes behind. Go to themondaypirates.com. Wherever you find this podcast, you'll be able to find the link to vote for her. So please do. You know, I'd like to be 1 degree away from Neil Gaiman.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be amazing. Oh, my God.
And then you'd be 2 degrees, and then you could go stand outside his house.
That would be amazing and weird.
On that note, thanks for listening to this episode of Do Nothing But Read. For more of this show and general geekery, check out themoderndaypirates.com. And while you're there, you can find all the books mentioned in this episode, and if you buy them through those links, you'll help us out.
Have a book you wish we would read? Send your episode ideas to podcastbookclub@gmail.com.
You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and while you're there, give us a rating. That would help us out. For more of Amanda's book reviews and views, go to dnbrd.org. You can follow me on Twitter at BB Werner.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Epistemophilia, spelled EPISTEMOPHILIA. Happy reading. I'm all year in list. Stomping on your fingers as you're clinging on to the abyss. So put on every winter coat that you own since 98.